Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. Half a dozen states held their primary elections this week, which gives us a clearer picture of how some of the nation's high-profile midterms races will shape up this fall. So, what do the tea leaves now tell us about control of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives? Fundamentally, voters care about one thing, the economy. Here's more from KCBS in the Bay Area.
American voters remain worried about their budgets and the economy. The Economist says a majority of voters think things are getting worse. To tell us what this means for President Trump and Republicans in the midterm elections, ABC News political analyst Steve Roberts. Are we seeing a Trump effect in the primaries so far?
Yes, we are, Steve. And it's a contradictory effect. You know, within the world of Republican primary voters, Donald Trump remains enormously popular. Look what he's able to do. He engineered the defeat in Republican primaries of two popular sitting Republican senators, Senator Cassidy of Louisiana, Senator Cornyn of Texas, because he felt they weren't loyal enough to him, not to the Republican Party, but to him personally. That's an enormously effective show of political power. But if you get outside that universe, that narrow universe of Republican primary voters, there's much a growing unhappiness. People who are no longer subject to Trump's political influence and political leverage. Look at this proposal that Trump pushed through recently, where he would create a $1.8 billion slush fund to reward and pay off some of his supporters, including some who were convicted of criminal activity at the Capitol, plus another provision that would shield his family from up to $100 million in potential penalties for tax audits in the future. Well, you get a Republican, Mitch McConnell. Now, he's the former Republican leader of the Senate, but he's not running again. He doesn't have to worry about a primary. He called this utterly stupid and morally wrong. Mike Pence, who Trump's former vice president, has broken with the president in the past, called it over the weekend on TV deeply offensive. So you have cross currents, Steve. You have the hardcore Trump supporters still loyal. But beyond that, there's much more growing dissatisfaction, and that this deal that Trump engineered with the IRS and the Justice Department symbolizes this growing discontent.
Yeah, more Republicans seem to be speaking out against the president or this particular proposal than I can certainly remember. Was there perhaps a red line that was crossed here where even Republicans are saying, all right, enough's enough?
Yes, I for some. Look, again, you know, a lot of Republicans are still afraid of Donald Trump. He showed his power by defeat. And Senator John Cornyn in Texas was a four-term Republican senator, highly popular with his colleagues in the Senate, a prodigious fundraiser who had raised hundreds of millions of dollars for his colleagues. Trump came out against him. He lost his primary by 25 points. So it's not as if Trump has lost the power to influence Republican primary voters. But the primary voters are not going to determine control of the Senate and control of the House in the fall. And Donald Trump's not going to be on the ballot again. But these other Republicans will be on the ballot. They're worried that this Trump's actions are going to drag them down. And I think in many ways, you can sum up the political problem Republicans are facing by one sentence, Steve, and that is, that's not what I voted for. Hmm.
Some Republicans have openly said they worry the fallout could actually swing the midterm elections out of their favor. I mean, you read the tea leaves in Washington. I know it's still early. We're nowhere near the November election yet. But is there a possibility of a change in the balance of power in Congress?
Well, absolutely. Look, let's also remember that history is against the Republicans. 20 of the last 22 midterm elections, the president's party has lost power and lost seats in the Congress. That's not an accident. That's not a random number. It's part of the essential cycle of American politics. First of all, any magnetic and effective presidential candidate pulls in voters who don't then vote 2 years later. I covered Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California, when I was the New York Times correspondent in Los Angeles, and I covered him when he was president. And he was enormously popular. But in 1982, after his huge victory in 1980, Republicans lost 26 seats in the House of Representatives because a lot of people who voted for Ronald Reagan didn't vote 2 years later. Well, Trump faces the same problem. But in addition, every president, successful candidate, makes promises they don't keep. It's built into the system. Donald Trump said, I'm going to end foreign wars, and he started one. He said, I'm going to reduce prices, and he and they've gone up. So the two basic reasons why the president's party almost always loses seats are very visible in terms of Trump. But in addition to that, Trump seems to have turned his attention away from the concerns that ordinary voters in San Francisco and everywhere else have. It's an iron rule of politics that the issues that matter the most are the ones that affect people directly around their kitchen tables. That's why Joe Biden lost, because he didn't pay attention to the rising prices, wasn't able to solve the problems, wasn't able to keep his promises. And today, Donald Trump is being drawn down by exactly the same forces that helped put him in the White House in the first place.
Speaking of money, housing costs continue to be a pinch point, even a breaking point. Here's a story in the Bay Area, where the median single-family home sits at approximately $1.25 million. Here's KCBS.
A Richmond family is staring down a rent hike that would force them out of the only home their toddler has ever known. KCBS's David Welch reports they're not alone, and they're not going without a fight.
Zach and Ashley Waldman have lived on Geary Boulevard since 2021. Two bedrooms, views of the Golden Gate Bridge. For them, it's more than just an address.
Over time, it's just become our home. And we have our 19-month-old son, which I think is why it hits the hardest for us.
The building sold this spring, and with it came a notice. Effective September 1st, rent was going from $3,700 to $7,000 a month. It's a condo built in 1996, outside of the reach of state and local rent control laws, but the Waldmans say they were told before signing that they were protected, and tenant advocates say that misrepresentation may give them a chance. Zach says their situation isn't unique.
More and more, you hear about situations where landlords are trying to buy out people, force people out.
The couple is hiring an attorney. The new landlord didn't return my call.
We want to be hopeful because this is our home.
In San Francisco, David Welch, KCBS.
With that happening, is it any wonder that many Americans are downsizing? Here's Noon Business Hour on WBBM in Chicago.
For many homeowners, especially empty nesters and retirees, downsizing is about more than moving to a smaller home. It's about simplifying life. We welcome in Lisa Stover, expert in senior transitions and owner of Presto Real Estate and Services in Naperville. Lisa, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And this is a rite of passage for homeowners, and let's face it, for their kids too, because when they downsize from that big home that you grew up into to something, a smaller place, maybe one with fewer stairs and fewer responsibilities, you as the child, you have to take all their stuff and find a place for it. So is that the first step in the downsizing journey?
Well, Rob, for many, it is the first step, because many of our downsizers have been collectors for years. So it really just depends on the person. You know, are they really looking forward to this move? Is it viewed as an adventure, or is it something that they're moving into with some trepidation and worry? Many of them are. And so it really, you know, you have to kind of approach it based on the mindset of the person making that move.
Logically and financially, downsizing makes plenty of sense, especially as you get older. But emotionally, it can be very difficult, especially if you're in a house that you've been in for decades, one where you have memories of graduation parties, of your children growing up, bringing children home from the hospital. Letting that go can be very hard.
It can be really hard. You know, we find that men tend to let go a little bit easier than women do, because women are usually more emotional. Of course, that's not always the case. But yes, you're absolutely right. There's so much tied to our homes. We say that home is where the heart is, and it's tough to tear a heart away. So it takes time, and it takes a lot of encouragement and talk. And you're right, kids don't want their parents' stuff. They don't want dining room sets. They don't want china. They certainly don't want precious moments for all of your listeners. They just don't.
And then once you go through the logistical component and the emotional component of moving on, what are some of the key things you should consider as you think about downsizing? When does the math make sense?
Well, honestly, right now, so many of our even older homeowners still have mortgages, and they're very low interest rates. So we're seeing a lot of pent-up demand, because if somebody wants to downsize into something smaller and they don't want to pay cash for it, they don't want a higher interest rate. So that's part of what we're dealing with. While a lot of homeowners have 100% equity and maybe moving into senior living, those homeowners don't care so much about what's happening out in the market, right? So it really is about what you need. Do you want to be closer to your family who lives across the country? Do you need some care so you're moving into a community that maybe is going to offer you the services that you need? Or are you very independent and just want something smaller and more manageable? Everyone is very different. But yes, all of these considerations come in, and they're so unique to each person.
And when you spend money, you want to get what you paid for, which is one of the reasons so many are upset at American Airlines. Here's more from WBBM.
Hey guys, Fly on the Wall is back for another season. That's right, on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
American Airlines is drawing criticism over a policy that could allow some first-class passengers to be downgraded to coach while the airline keeps most of the money. We welcome in Joe Sweeterman, professor of public services and director of the Chaddick Institute at DePaul University in Chicago. Joe, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And what is the American Airlines logic behind downgrading first-class passengers into coach?
Yeah, this one, I think, got away from American Airlines, and they're controlling the narrative, as I think is important in these situations. But there's a lot of instances where there may be a broken seat, there may be a reconfiguration of an aircraft, there may be some other problems where they don't have enough first-class seats, and they have to figure out a fair compensation to the person that's pushed down to coach. In the past, they've been much more generous about that, whether you get some sort of compensation or free trip or most of your money back. They're going to go to a flat 40%, which I suspect they would argue is a fair amount. But devil's in the details, and customers are not happy. And you surprise people at the airport, and people think they get a bad shake. It really can get emotional.
Now, logic would suggest that if you downgrade somebody from first class into coach, you would get the exact difference between the first class fare and the coach fare for that particular flight. But the prices of the flights up front and in the back are such a moving target. American Airlines going to the flat fee probably avoids doing a deep dive into the budget math on that particular flight.
Oh, that's right. I mean, you buy in the coach cabin, you're 3 months ahead, you're going to get, you know, pay 25% what you pay for a coach seat. So it will seem unfair to get 40% back. If you book at the last minute and get a refundable fare, and it's cancelable, and you're the last one to be bumped and all that, you know, you'll pay more. So 40% would be fair in that instance. So I think they're finding that there's so much demand for these first class seats that they want to find a way to deal with the fact this is going to start becoming more common. you know, they're reconfiguring airplanes, the fuel prices are high, they're trying to, in some cases, they have more business class seats and fewer first, and they got to do something with the people that are booked. Now, I will say that it's really unfortunate they haven't had a more clear explanation, because I think the social media is having a bit of a field day with this.
Markets are lower. Joining us with the latest in what's moving Wall Street is Gary Kaltbaum, President, Kaltbaum Capital Management, Fox News business contributor. It seems like just a little bit of nervousness is seeping in today after a couple of days of gains.
I think gravity's taking over, as well as oil prices and yields ticking up. I gather there's got to be some worry about, I think it was Rubio yesterday saying the war is over, and then last night, Iran blowing up half the earth. So I think that's part of the equation. But look, we've had a real good run, normal to pull back. The semiconductors are not pulling back. They're still leading again today. But leave no doubt, if oil prices start going north again and take yields with them, you get some headwinds.
A strong ADP private payrolls report out today with over 100,000 new jobs per ADP created in the month of May. And we don't know what the government jobs report for Friday says. They're often divergent numbers because of different methodology. But is this a case, though, where good news for people looking for a job may be bad news for equities?
Not necessarily. Again, I really do believe the inflation part of the equation is really ruling the roost, and that is energy prices. You can almost time things to that. So I think that's what's doing it. 100,000 jobs is okay. Give me 250 and I'm a happy guy. So I'm not so worried about there. And a strong economy does not necessarily equal inflation. I know there's some people out there that think that, but I've seen unbelievably strong economies and no inflation for a very long time. So that doesn't worry me as much.
And then when it comes to assessing the economic impact of the Iran war, when you look at how equities are performing, and then you try to square that with some of the rhetoric that is coming from energy analysts about how a real crunch could be coming if the Strait of Hormuz remains closed for a long time, is this a matter of investors hearing what they want to hear, or that we're in uncharted territory when it comes to oil price pressures and it's very difficult to price that in?
I think if you take out technology, the market would look a lot worse. Technology has been a beast, especially the semis and the artificial intelligence trade. But if you look at retail, terrible. The stocks are acting terribly. Housing, they're in bear markets. A lot of the travel, bearish. The restaurant stocks, a lot of them have crashed. So the consumer-oriented areas are not doing the job. But technology is such a huge influence on the indices. That's what's really driving the bus. And that's why we watch them so closely. If they start coming in, I can promise you the market will start coming in.
What is your freedom number? Personal finance experts say identifying the amount needed to live life on your own terms is a key step toward achieving financial independence. We welcome in Michael Bogardis, certified financial planner with the Harbor Oak team at Barnum Financial Group in Shelton, Connecticut. Now, I have heard a less diplomatic name for freedom number, and I'm sure you have too. But does this basically operate on the same principle, whereas you save enough money so you could potentially quit your job or downgrade to part-time and start doing your own thing?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's about flexibility, saving up a certain nest egg that allows you to accomplish a different set of goals.
And of course, that really, it's a different number for different people. But if you want to calculate your freedom number just to give yourself a goal, what are some things you need to take into consideration in calculating that figure?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the main thing is understanding what your lifestyle requires from an income perspective. And then after that, it's just really working backwards, factoring in things such as taxes, inflation, you know, Social Security benefits, healthcare costs, family benefits, longevity assumptions. You know, there's a whole laundry list, but once you really start to understand your income goals, you can figure out how much you need in assets to support those needs.
And generally, for whom should this apply? Because if you have kids at home, chances are you're probably not calculating your freedom number unless you are doing especially well at work.
Yeah, I think the freedom number really gets a lot of play maybe on social media for people looking to maybe spread their wings and gain more independence. But at the end of the day, I think it probably is more relevant to individuals getting ready for retirement and starting out to plan that next phase when the paycheck stops.
And then let's take a look at, you know, really digging into your monthly spending needs and how you can adjust them so you can live life on your own terms. So what are some of the first places to start?
Yeah, that's difficult, especially nowadays with consumer goods increasing and the ever-increasing costs in healthcare. It's not the easiest thing in the world to adjust one's income needs. So I think when it comes to budgeting, I think the most important thing, especially for individuals in relationships, is just having open dialogue with their significant other to understand, you know, what are their needs and what are their wants. I know it's a very basic way to look at the budget, but at the end of the day, certain things have to continue. We need to pay our bills, our mortgage, our utilities, but other things are negotiable. But a lot of times when we deal with clients, that list is different for both individuals in a relationship. So you got to get that out into the open.
Now, let's talk about this in terms of making it an actionable financial goal. Maybe you cannot achieve your freedom number today, but perhaps you could do it 10 years from now so that your retirement age, you can start winding down your professional journey long before you actually enter retirement or are officially retired. So what are some things you can do now to make sure you hit that freedom number, let's say, in 2031 or 2035?
You want to try to automate as much of your finances as possible, whether that's contributing to a 401k coming right out of your paycheck, or opening up a brokerage account and putting in a monthly amount, or paying down a little bit extra on your mortgage payments. You want to automate. I truly think that's one of the keys to financial success and freedom, is putting things on autopilot as much as you can.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Berry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.